Why are some of the world's most creative minds among those most afflicted with mental illness? This hour, one of the world's leading neuroscientists shares her research on that very question. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today, we spend the hour with renowned psychiatrist and neuroscientist, Dr. Nancy Andreessen. She's spent decades studying creativity. For many of the subjects in one of her studies, who were all writers from the Iowa Writers' Workshop, mental illness and creativity went hand in hand. A little later, we'll be joined by Writers' Workshop director Samantha Chang for her view on creativity. The Secrets of the Creative Brain. First, this news. What does it mean to be creative? What is creativity anyway? And is there a connection between high IQ and creativity? Why are some of the world's most creative minds among those most afflicted with mental illness? What goes into those eureka or aha moments that bring us to a new realization or insight? It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today, we spent the hour examining these and other fascinating questions with renowned psychiatrist and neuroscientist Dr. Nancy Andreessen. She spent decades studying creativity. She's going to share her research this hour about where genius comes from, whether it's dependent, for instance, on a high IQ, and why it's so often accompanied by mental illness. That's the subject of a recent article she's written for The Atlantic titled Secrets of the Creative Brain. Dr. Andreessen is the Andrew H. Woods Chair of Psychiatry at the University of Iowa College of Medicine. She joins us by phone. Dr. Andreessen, welcome.
Glad to be here.
Listeners, what are your questions about the nature of creativity? Share our conversation this hour, 1-866-780-9100, river-to-river at iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Facebook, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. Dr. Andreessen, you recount in your article that you spent much of your career focusing on the neuroscience of mental illness, but in more recent decades, you focused on what you might call the science of genius, work in which you tried to discern what combination of elements tends to create particularly creative brains. First of all, creativity is a hard thing to define. How do you define it?
Well, I agree. It is a hard thing to define, and there are many different ways to do it. The definition that I like to use and that a lot of other experts in creativity share is that creativity is the capacity to produce something that is novel or original, but is also useful. And particularly the component useful needs amplification, because some people might infer, gosh, useful means inventing light bulbs or electric motors or something like that, but useful really extends to very much to the arts, to music and literature, visual arts, dance, those kinds of things. So the arts are useful in that they, I would say, elevate the human spirit, inspire us, lead us to think more broadly about lots of different things.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to one of your earlier studies on creativity. Your subjects were all writers from the Iowa Writers' Workshop. In that early study, what did you set out to do?
I began that study shortly after I finished a psychiatry residency and after I had gone to medical school. And it was never intended to be my primary occupation. It was more of something I did on the side. And I did it in the context of having thought a lot about people like Albert Einstein, who had a son with schizophrenia, Bertrand Russell, who had a family full of schizophrenia. And I had a colleague named Len Heston, who had done a study of the adopted children of mothers with schizophrenia and mothers who had no mental illness. And he found that the adopted children of the mothers with schizophrenia had a higher rate of creativity than the adopted children of mothers who didn't have schizophrenia. And the adopted offspring design is a very powerful design to separate nature from nurture, because obviously the children did not grow up with their biological parents. They grew up in a totally different environment. And so Len, who was on our faculty here, and I talked back and forth quite a bit about how there might be some subtle connection between schizophrenia and creativity, the ability to see things in a novel way. So I began the study thinking that when I interviewed writers from the Iowa Writers' Workshop, they wouldn't particularly have any problems, but that their first-degree relatives, which are mothers and fathers and brothers and sisters and children, would have a higher rate of schizophrenia, because that was the model. And what I found instead was that the writers themselves had a higher rate of problems, and particularly mood disorder. They also had a higher rate of primarily mood disorder in their first-degree relatives, and they also had a higher rate of creativity in their first-degree relatives. So it's an example of starting a study expecting one thing and finding something completely different from what you anticipated. And I was very surprised when I started interviewing the writers and heard them describe the various problems that they'd had with especially mood disorder.
Mm-hmm. You had writers in this first study, Kurt Vonnegut, others in the study as well, Richard Yates, John Cheever. So what conclusions did you come to after the end of that first study about, well, specifically mental illness and creativity, the connection?
Well, I had to come to the conclusion that writers, at least, had a higher rate of mental illness, mood disorder, and that it, as I said, it ran in their families. And so there's a suggestion of heritability. Of course, with that design, I couldn't really completely disentangle nature and nurture, because, if they had more creativity in their families, it might have been through role modeling rather than through something that was inherited. But one thing that was interesting was that the creativity in family members was not necessarily literary creativity. And the Vonnegut family is a good example. His father was a gifted architect. His uncle was a physical chemist who was an inventor. And his children had various forms of creativity that were primarily non-literary. So, the conclusion was that there was a link between creativity and mental illness. But it's important to point out that this should not be misinterpreted to say, as some people have in summarizing the study, creative people are crazy, which is a statement that I find abhorrent. I mean, I tremendously dislike the use of words like crazy. What was the case was that the writers whom I interviewed described periods in general, they described periods where they had been depressed, but it's important to realize they were normal most of the time. Mood disorder is a transient problem, and people may have a depression that lasts for a few weeks, a month, maybe a little longer, but it doesn't mean that writers are, chronically always suffering from a mental illness.
Mm-hmm. A little later in your research on this, you looked at another question. Why does creativity run in families? And related to that, what is it that gets transmitted? What conclusions did you come to there?
That's a complicated question. I think that what gets transmitted is almost a way of approaching life and the world. It's a propensity to be adventuresome, curious, take risks, go out on a limb, think in original ways. And when you have a personality like that or an approach to life like that, it just makes you more vulnerable. more vulnerable to rejection, more vulnerable to having people not necessarily understand why you're doing what you're doing. And also in the case of being a writer, you know, when you write something, you submit it, and every writer gets their work, his or her work, turned down. And so, and yet the person has to persist and resubmit again. So rejection is another thing that kind of may predispose.
Mm-hmm. At least those who are successful, we would say those who get rejected will not be successful. They may be creative, but no one ever finds out about it?
Ask that question again.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm just saying that this quality of being resilient to being put up with rejection when you see the world or something in a different way, that those who didn't put up with rejection, we would not know about their creativity.
That's true, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, they may not be creative.
Right. You talk about creativity being dangerous in this article. Having too many ideas can be dangerous. Explain that.
Well, the background of that is that in that particular part of the article, I'm talking about the relationship between creativity and particularly psychosis, because I use the example of John Nash. And, you know, in this second study, which we haven't really talked about, right, I interviewed a number of creative artists and also creative scientists, and a number of them described to me how they had lots and lots of ideas, and that in itself is a, you know, kind of an energizing experience, but to be successful, they had to be able to pick out which ideas were going to be productive and useful. And what that means is that they had some ideas that are bad ideas, that are wrong ideas. And it's in that sense that having too many ideas can be dangerous. And then I went on to use the example of John Nash, the mathematician who got the Nobel Prize for discovering game theory. And I concluded the article by saying some people have lots of original ideas, and they're right, and we call them creative. Some people have lots of ideas, and they're wrong, and we call them mentally ill, and then some people, like John Nash, are both.
Dr. Nancy Andreessen is my guest this hour, a renowned psychiatrist and neuroscientist. She spent decades studying creativity and her research on where genius comes from, whether it's dependent on high IQ, and why it's often accompanied by mental illness, is the subject of an article, recent article in The Atlantic magazine titled The Secrets of the Creative Brain. Let's talk about this second creative study. Your aim here, following the workshop study years prior to that, the questions you wanted to answer when you looked at what you called individual jewels of creativity, George Lucas, William Thurston, Jane Smiley. What did you want to get at there?
Well, when I finished the workshop study, which was a very interesting experience, and a surprising one, as I've described, when I finished it, I said to myself, I wonder if there's something about writing that inherently predisposes to developing depressions. And I wonder what I would find, because writing is a lonely kind of thing. You have to do it by yourself. It takes a lot of effort. And as we've said, you submit your stuff and get it rejected, at least occasionally. What would happen if I studied another kind of creativity? And I thought about music. I thought about dance. I thought about the visual arts. And then I said, well, I wonder what would happen if I had a mixture of people who are artists of various kinds and a mixture of people who are scientists of various kinds. Would I find a different pattern in the sciences than I would find in the arts? And so actually about 20 years elapsed between the workshop study and this more recent one, where I am studying people from the arts and the sciences. And in this case, the design was to identify people who had very high achieved very high achievements, people who, you know, anybody would say, gosh, he's creative. And so I've been collecting people who have gotten prizes of various kinds. You mentioned Bill Thurston, who got the Fields Medal, George Lucas, who's gotten loads of different awards, Jane Smiley, who's gotten the Pulitzer. And I wanted to ask the question, would I find different patterns among the scientists as compared to the artists?
Mm-hmm. And talk a little bit about the process that you cannot reveal information about these individuals, about them. What can you tell us? You can tell us about the process that you are, and it's ongoing, I believe, the process that you are taking each of these people through.
Yes, so I contact them, and I basically have generated a list of people who would be good candidates for the study because they've gotten Fields Medals or Nobel Prizes or whatever. And I contact them and invite them to participate, and I explain, I have a form letter that I use, and I explain, you know, who has already been in the study and what kinds of things they will be doing. And one of the things is that this is different from the workshop study in that it includes neuroimaging studies of the brain. And so they come to Iowa City, and as the study has evolved, there is a pattern, which is the process you're asking me to describe. They usually come in on a Sunday, and I pick them up at the airport. And, you know, it's Iowa, and so we're innately hospitable. And so I bring them to my home, which is about 10 miles, even less, from the airport, and is a 40-acre nature retreat. I've gotten a little bit of flack from people who assume that having a 40-acre nature retreat makes you a wealthy snob. But you and I know that having 40 acres in Iowa doesn't make you a wealthy snob. In fact, it makes you the opposite. Anyway, it's a beautiful, it's about 20 acres of woods and about 20 acres of pasture. And they come here. I fix dinner for them. And we relax and get to know one another. And I initially designed it this way just to be hospitable, but it turns out that it's a really good way to begin the study. They, relax. We chat about all different kinds of things. It's a beautiful setting. We hop in an ATV and ride around a little bit and see blue herons flying or bald eagles, or on one occasion we saw a mink. And then the next day, they really have to work hard for a day and a half. The first thing we do is the MR scan, and for that they have to be in the scanner for an hour and a half. It's really potentially a very stressful experience. Everybody has been a real trooper about it. After that, they actually have lunch with our research team, and it's great fun for the people in my research group to be able to sit around and chat with people like George Lucas or Bill Thurston. And then that afternoon, I spend most of the afternoon interviewing them, and it's a structured interview. Everybody gets the same questions, and the interview is about, you know, their family when they were growing up, their interests and hobbies, how they decided to go into whatever they do, how they get their ideas, why they've gone in the directions that they've gone. Mm-hmm. And then the next day they have some cognitive testing, and then we spend about 2 hours going through their imaging data and just generally what we've learned from the study.
I wonder if you could go back to that. We have a break in about 3 or 4 minutes, but go back to the MRI. So they're in this tube, which you have to be in to have an MRI, and you are having them do what? You're trying to image their brain being creative or having a eureka moment?
No, that's not what I'm trying to do. How many minutes do we have? Because this is a fairly complicated answer.
Well, we have about 4 minutes before we break.
Okay. So I had, when I decided I wanted to do a second study, and I decided I wanted to do imaging, the challenge was to figure out how to design a task or a group of tasks that would tap into the creative process. And most people think of the creative process as involving a eureka moment, but there's really no way that you can put somebody in an MR scan and tell them, okay, I have a eureka moment.
Right.
You can't put somebody in an MR scan and, say, make up a story and have that necessarily tap into the creative process.
Right. So what do you do?
Well, as I say, it's a longish answer, but very simply, and we can return to this after the break, the process of creativity starts with something that I call preparation, where you assemble information, and that is part of, you know, education as people are growing up. Then there's a period, you know, they probably identified questions. There's a period of incubation, and that's usually a relaxed period, and people describe how, it, you know, their ideas began to occur to them when they're running or taking a shower or whatever. That's the eureka moment. And then the final step is, you know, execution, completion. The question that I asked myself was, how can I tap into particularly that incubation period that leads to the eureka moment? And I concluded that that incubation period is a time when people are making connections. The human brain, you know, when we think, we have ideas floating around in our heads. And when the actual eureka moment occurs, people make connections, and the part of the brain that does that is what we call the association cortex. So what they do in the scanner is a series of tasks that I would say stress test, you know, kind of like a cardiac stress test, that mm-hmm. stress test the association cortex. Mm-hmm. So they do a word association task, a picture association task, and then a pattern completion task. And it turns out that in both healthy normals and in our creative people, the association cortex does light up, as we would say colloquially, activate during these three tasks.
Okay, we have to take a short break. Dr. Nancy Andreessen, please stay with us. This is fascinating, the science of the creative brain. Renowned psychiatrist and neuroscientist Dr. Nancy Andreessen with us. As we take this break, listen to the work of one undisputed creative genius, Peter Tchaikovsky. Certainly had an eureka moment to make this work, Swan Lake. When we come back in just a moment, we'll have another guest with us, University of Iowa Writers Workshop Director Samantha Chang. We'll ask her about the nature of creativity at the workshop. Of course, the UI, home to the Writers Workshop, the oldest and most famous creative writing program in the United States. That's when we come back. Dr. Nancy Andreessen, Samantha Chang, The Science of the Creative Brain. When River to River continues in just a moment, this is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer today. The Science of the Creative Brain with renowned psychiatrist and neuroscientist Dr. Nancy Andreessen. She's spent decades studying creativity. She studied University of Iowa Writers Workshop people, looking at where genius comes from, whether it's dependent on high IQ and why it's so often accompanied by mental illness. In just a moment, we'll have the University of Iowa Writers Workshop director, Samantha Chang, join us. But let's finish up this conversation, Dr. Andreessen, about your latest study, Creative Study 2, where you use today's neuroimaging tools, part of the process, to study all sorts of connections, make brain measurements, imaging in creative ways. So you look at their brains, the scans and the MRI, then you interview them. Do you broach the idea, the topic of mental illness? How do these people react, which, as you stated before, are people like George Lucas and Jane Smiley, but others not necessarily from writers' backgrounds or the arts, for instance?
Mm-hmm. Well, as I said, I have a structured interview, and it begins with their early life experiences and, you know, what their parents were like, what their siblings were like, and what their educational background is, what the, you know, family rearing was like. And in the process of that, I just simply ask, have you had any problems with any mental illnesses? And some say, well, yes, and some say no. And the article in Atlantic has generated a lot of feedback, and some people have suggested that I'm trying to convince these people that they should come up with stories about mental illness. That just isn't the case at all. Mm-hmm. I ask a very open-ended question, and they say yes or no. And, of course, if they say yes or I'm not sure, I ask more questions to, you know, determine what the symptoms were like, how long they lasted, and that kind of thing. Nobody seems to be the least bit bothered by being asked that question. And
are you finding the same sort of results you did with your workshop study when you have this broader pool of jewels of creativity that similarly there is a higher incidence of mental illness?
The simple answer is yes. I mean, in each study, I've had a comparison group that's matched to the subjects, the creative subjects, on gender, age, and educational status. So I'm getting ultimately quantitative data in terms of the rates of in each of the two groups. In this second study, the rates of mental illness in the subjects are lower than in the workshop study. I don't have enough subjects to give quantitative results yet, but it's clear that there is more mental illness in them than in the comparison group. The kinds of mental illness are a bit more diverse than in the workshop study. Mm-hmm. There is some mood disorder. There's some anxiety disorder. One individual described himself as saying, you know, I think I have something in the autism spectrum. I mean, he just spontaneously came up with that. And one person probably has something that's kind of in the schizophrenia spectrum. So it's a more diverse pattern of illness. And so far the rates are somewhat lower. But it's, as I say, it's premature to make any real generalizations.
Psychiatrist and neuroscientist Dr. Nancy Andreessen of the University of Iowa. Joining us now, Samantha Chang, director of the University of Iowa Writers' Workshop. She's also the May Broadback Professor of Liberal Arts and Sciences at the University of Iowa, of course, home to the Writers' Workshop, the oldest and most famous creative writing program in the United States. Professor Chang, welcome to our program.
Hi.
You've been listening to this conversation. Fascinating to try to put the tools of science to work to dissect creativity, what's happening in our brain with these tools of neuroimaging. How does this match up with the creativity you see recognized and exercised at the University of Iowa Writers' Workshop?
Well, I'm also a professor of fiction writing at the workshop, and I handle the admissions for fiction, the fiction program, and we receive, you know, around 1,000, sometimes more or less, applications to the program every year, and we choose 25 students. And when we're looking at the applications, we look only at the creative work. And what we're looking for, I think, is strength in the work, not necessarily a creative person. However, I was thinking this over, listening to Nancy talk, and it occurred to me that it's possible to be a good writer, but not to show much signs of creativity. And in your writing, you can have everything sort of line up. Mm-hmm. You can write a story with all the parts that a story is supposed to have, according to Aristotle. But if it doesn't work, if it doesn't sort of feel like the real world, like it's coming off the page, then it's not of interest to us. So there's something we look for that I suppose you could describe as creativity in the work. And so we end up with a lot of students who are what you might call creative people. Listening to the show, I was thinking about mood disorder, and I'm not a psychiatrist, so I'm not entirely sure what the sort of rules, you know, the sort of standards of mood disorder are right now. But what I have noticed is a certain amount of understanding among the students that getting down or feeling a little depressed or maybe very depressed is sort of completely normal. Everybody understands that their friends and classmates go through periods where they're not feeling so happy about themselves and their work. And the thing that's of interest to me is that we also understand that people come out of those periods. And it seems to me, you know, this obviously I'm not a psychiatrist, that there's a relationship between the periods when you're kind of hiding out in your apartment and the periods when you are able to emerge with new work. And this brings me to thinking about why the Iowa Writers Workshop is, as that you were saying, the most famous and the oldest program in creative writing in the country. I think because it gives people a lot of time to sort of go into themselves, to sort of go through this incubation period that Nancy was talking about. But I also think that the program allows for a sort of compassionate understanding that there's a certain creative process that everyone can go through.
Why do you think it is that this incidence of mental illness is higher among writers associated with this fiction workshop or others, I would assume? Why do they have to coexist?
I don't know if they have to coexist. Also, I should say poetry is half fiction and half poetry. And the only reason I talk about fiction writers is that I'm a fiction professor. But I think that the people in the workshop who are related to poetry would also understand what I'm talking about to some extent. I don't know if they have to coexist. I just know that the people in our program are interested in writing work that encompasses the human condition, and the human condition has many, many, many parts. I think if you were to ask me to describe a writer's brain, I would say that it's a brain that has more parts than a lot of other people's. And so those connections that Nancy was talking about are just necessary. So somebody who has more parts is able to see joy and also able to see sorrow, sometimes simultaneously. And that's what I've observed. I've observed people who are able to sort of understand a spectrum of human emotions and human situations.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Andresen, as we listen to that, I wonder if the research that you're doing might, in a way, eventually, one day, lead to understanding of the brain, a scientific understanding of the brain, that we can more effectively deal with things like writer's block when we talk about associations. Is that stretching it too far that we might understand it to the extent so that writers, creative writers, can be more productive and not have these long periods of incubation?
You know, I think it's dangerous to overstress what we can learn about the brain and about the brain in relation to creativity, and particularly to use that to prevent things. The human brain is so complicated, and there is a push to try to oversimplify its nature so that we can say, oh gosh, you know, A, I've located creativity in the brain, B, I've understood writer's block, and C, that will prevent me to prescribe a cure for it. I don't think it's ever going to be that simple because, as Sam has said, the creative process itself is complex and the brain is complex. And much as I know you'd like me to give you a simple answer, I just can't.
Right.
I would like to make a quick comment on something that she said, which is just to agree with it. You know, and there are many famous examples of writers like, say, Virginia Woolf, who did have prolonged periods of depression, and those appear to be times when she incubated, then came out of them and, you know, produced great novels.
One of my theories about the University of Iowa Writers' Workshop is that it's successful because we have a long winter here.
You really?
I really
more than in jest. Yeah.
I actually use it as a recruiting tool.
How do you use
it? Well, you have a lot of time to think in the winter. I mean, I think that great work comes out of this program because people hole up and they, you know, they can't go out and they think. They do sort of peaceful tasks. They knit.
May I mention, you are actually knitting, or we're knitting.
Yes,
while
I was.
Listening to, and that is something more than creating a garment for this winter. You are actually doing what?
I think that knitting is one of the repetitive processes that help me get into a space where I'm thinking creatively. Mm-hmm. I can also listen better when my hands are occupied.
Mm-hmm. What do you know why that would be, Dr. Andreessen, that Samantha Chang can knit? Is it similar to taking a warm shower? It's relaxing?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, when I interview these people, a lot of it is about just the nature of their creative process. And the interviews are recorded and then they're transcribed and they run to around 35 pages long. Single space, 10-point font. So there's a mass of information in there about, you know, their lives and the nature of the creative process. And I think almost 100% of them talk about something that is related to this period when incubation occurs, you know, when they're running, when they're driving a car, or when they're doing,
walking.
Yeah.
Knitting
makes a great deal of sense. It's something that I would think would permit your brain to go into a restful state when, again, thoughts float around and then some good idea emerges.
Is that what you're doing? Have you, Samantha Chang, had eureka experiences while knitting?
I don't actually tell myself, okay, now you need a eureka experience. You need to go knit.
You can never do that.
Yeah. This is the problem with trying to figure out ways to increase people's quote-unquote productivity as creative people. Like, okay.
Being too much of a Henry Ford, wasn't
you
I?
I figured you were sort of trying to provoke us. I think actually that that it's impossible to say, but I know that it helps me put my brain in a restful state.
Mm-hmm. Let's say a few words as we close. If you just joined us, I'm with University of Iowa Writers Workshop Director Samantha Chang and psychiatrist and neuroscientist Dr. Nancy Andreessen. We have just under 10 minutes left. And I wanted to finish up by giving our listeners something to go on, because a lot of us are parents. I know you've explored the nature and nurture of creativity, Dr. Andreessen, that we can leave our audience with a few words about that. What do we know about nature and nurture? And we know that we didn't talk about it much, but creativity is much more than high intelligence. But if we want to nurture creativity in our young people as parents, what do we know about the science of doing that, Dr. Andreessen? And then Samantha Chang, please.
Well, I don't think there's a simple answer to that, but I do think that regimented education is not as enriching for the creative process as education that permits kids to do things that are more exploratory. One of the things that has come out of interviewing the group that I've just been working with is that they – two things, really. One is that they are what's known as autodidacts. They really like to teach themselves things. They don't like to be spoon-fed. Many of them taught themselves to read when they were 3 or 4 years old, and many of them in their school experiences found that a really structured curriculum was a bit oppressive. Another trait is that many of them are what are known as polymaths. They have multiple interests. They're good at many things. And the tendency to encourage kids to go in a track, to be more in the arts or more in the sciences, is, I think, something that also diminishes creativity, because people who are broader, who can understand, let's just say, aspects of the arts and aspects of the sciences, particularly the natural world, are going to have a bigger worldview. And, you know, Sam, I was thinking of Paul Harding and how beautiful his writing is. And it, part of it is because he really loves the natural world.
Sure. I think that it takes interest in more than one field in order to create something that's deep. I guess as a parent, I think about this question. Honestly, this is what I think. What we haven't talked about during this hour is the difference between what was being called wrong ideas and right ideas.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that encouraging children to make mistakes and to keep putting out their ideas is really important, because I don't think they're wrong and right ideas. I think they're people who are able to stand rejection and people who can't. And that if one were to try to make a child as quote-unquote creative as possible, because what we're really talking about here is people who've succeeded in the world with their creativity, I suppose that that would require a certain hardiness to rejection and a sort of a feeling that rejection isn't bad. And that's what I would do. But again, I'm not talking about actually encouraging that the associative depth of creativity. I think that's something that comes from being in the world and its individual process in a lot of ways.
I wanted to ask you about another line in this article in The Atlantic, Dr. Andreessen. You write, "I've been struck by how many of these creative people refer to their most creative ideas as obvious." What does that tell you about them, that it's so apparent to them when most of the rest, if not all of the rest of the people have been, of humanity, have been blind to it up to that point?
You know, that may come up a little more within the sciences, and I'd be interested in hearing what Sam has to say about it in relation to the arts or writing in particular. But the key idea is that they have an ability to see things, to perceive things that other people can't. I'm working on a book on great physicists, Newton and Faraday and Maxwell, and those people just clearly had a capacity to visually see things, to intuit a reality that other people didn't see. And to them it's obvious, but to other people it isn't. James Clerk Maxwell, one of the greatest physicists ever, maybe the greatest, made discoveries that nobody else really understood or believed for 30 or 40 years. Took Einstein to come along and actually understand what he was saying.
Mm-hmm. Samantha Chang, do you have a eureka experience that you recall in terms of writing you'd like to share?
Well, one thing I will say is that one of my novels took me 10 years from start to finish to work on, and I think I did probably the most productive work on that novel within a 3-month span during like the 5th year, and then another 3-month span during the 9th year. So in other words, there were years that went by when I was just sort of wandering around in the world of the novel.
You know, incubating.
I don't know if – I mean, I was actively attempting to do work, but the real work was done in these spurts, and I don't think there was a way that I could control that.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Andreessen, can you – we have a minute or so left to relay a eureka experience that you've had.
Oh, they're not particularly interesting to anybody except me, but when I realized that the essence of schizophrenia is – what we call negative symptoms. It's not psychosis, the colorful delusions and hallucinations. It's the emptiness that people with schizophrenia have, and I designed ways to study that. When I decided to do imaging, that was a eureka moment, when I realized that tapping the association cortex was the way to study creativity. That was a eureka experience.
And there's still, briefly, there's no way that you can predict when you'll have such an experience or how to prompt them.
No. Well, I mean, no.
Okay. I want to thank you both very much for joining this hour to talk about the science of the creative brain. Dr. Nancy Andreessen is a psychiatrist and neuroscientist. She spent decades studying creativity, and we've been talking about this hour largely the subject of a recent article she wrote for The Atlantic titled Secrets of the Creative Brain. Dr. Andreessen, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Dr. Andreessen is the Andrew H. Woods Chair of Psychiatry at the University of Iowa College of Medicine. And also thanks to Samantha Chang, University of Iowa Writers Workshop Director, for coming in today, knitting and sharing your thoughts. We appreciate it.
It's a pleasure.
River to River is produced by Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, and Claire Roth. Tomorrow on this program, we'll look at what happens to a small town in Iowa when a meat processing plant closes its doors and leaves a portion of the town's population without work. Cherokee, Iowa, in the spotlight tomorrow. Catherine Perkins is our executive producer. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.